stageandstudio.com. I'll have the show later online today at stageandstudio.org. Like us on facebook.com/stage_and_studio and tweet me at @stage_and_studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Happening 2016, a homegrown music forum taking place February 27th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Apano Jam Space in Portland. Happening 2016 will be an exploratory conversation about how the music scene works in Portland and how artists, professionals, and supporters shape the scene. Panelists include Simon Tam, Jenny Logan, DJ Cliff, and will be moderated by Rebecca Miller. Again, that's Happening 2016, a homegrown music forum taking place February 27th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Apano Jam Space, 8114 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Andy Warhol looks a scream.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Phil Sylvester. He's an artist whose main medium is drawing, and he has a show on now called Countenance with David Slater. It's at Gallery 114 through February the 28th. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Phil.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So this show is six big drawings framed. They're probably how wide? About
2 feet by 3 feet.
Yeah. And they're pencil, like 2B pencil, pretty simple. And you draw without looking at the paper. So you're looking at the subject. These are heads, and you're talking all the time to the subject. And they're very kind of, I don't know, scribbly. I don't know what the word is.
Yep.
Action. I would say the marks are very fast. And then you take an eraser and you erase white lines onto it. So it's pretty amazing to me that you have this technique of just looking at the subject and letting your hand decide what the marks are. So just tell us what the effect is.
Well, the part of drawing that most interests me is studying the structure of the subject through drawing. And I can study that with the greatest complexity if I'm not worrying a lot about fixing the drawing itself. And so I have my eyes riveted onto the subject, and then my hand is moving mostly without my looking at the paper. And I go over the surface thousands of times, going back and forth between putting down dark marks and putting down erasure marks. And the only time I look at the paper is just to see if there are places on the drawing that need more attention, need more observation. Mm-hmm. But the drawing itself is not really controlled. It's really much more the sort of residue of intensely studying the subject.
So five of these drawings are of a guy called Gary. Gary's a good friend of yours. He's a psychiatrist and a painter. So you like just sitting there talking to Gary because he's interesting.
Yes, talking partly is a distraction for part of my brain so that my drawing isn't so deliberate and intellectual, but is more of a reflection of a sensibility and more physical, coming more out of my body. Mm-hmm. And so Gary has an incredibly interesting face and also is really fun to talk to. And when I work from a subject, I'll work from it for, well, I've drawn from Gary for 5 years, every week for 5 years. So, and I could easily imagine drawing five more years. I mean, I haven't even begun to exhaust the complexity of his face.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at these pictures, they you can see eyes, nose, a sort of, you know, a chin, a hairline sometimes. The hair, it looks like hair because it's pencil line, but then you use the same type of line to do everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're taking off the pencil with what kind of erasers do you use?
Well, I use white vinyl erasers, Staedtler Mars block erasers, but also Zero erasers from Japan. They're very small, detailed white vinyl erasers.
Mm-hmm. And you take it off with the same kind of vigor with
same, yes, it's all very, very physical. And there's no actual order. I just go back and forth, dark, light, dark, light, dark, light.
So you're not just adding highlights to the nose, chin, and forehead?
No. In some ways, the marks are doing the same thing that the dark marks are, the erasure marks. They are following the surface of the volumes and the space of the face. They probably concentrate a little more in the areas where there's light, but I'm willing to put erasure marks anywhere. The erasure marks partly reopen the drawing, because if I'm just doing dark marks, eventually the whole drawing just becomes black. And so because I work on this many layers to keep the drawing at all complex, I have to be subtracting as well as adding.
Mm-hmm. So that, like, Gary number one would be like 4 2-hour sittings? Is that about
anywhere
right?
From, yes, I think Gary number one may even have been 1 2-hour sitting, but typically this each drawing is anywhere from 2 hours to 8 hours. And if it's 8 hours, I revisit it 3 times after the first session. One of the things is that it's very unpredictable whether the drawings are going to have any kind of coherence. So I will often have a failure rate of 100 to 1, 100 mm-hmm. drawings for one that has this quality of structure and ambiguity that I'm really interested in.
Mm-hmm. So you want to capture the volume of the man's head, the three-dimensional sense of it?
The volume and the surface, but even beyond that, I want to have a way of drawing that lets me observe the head in any way I can imagine. So if I see component geometries or axes or surface or volume or light, or this way of marking allows me to go back and forth among all these different ways of seeing.
Mm-hmm. So is this technique yours alone?
Well, I don't see anybody else making drawings very much like mine at the moment, but the roots of my drawing are pretty clear. I think the willingness to mark an element in many different ways comes mostly from my studying Cézanne's works on paper, particularly the late watercolors. My technique is very similar to Giacometti's paintings, where he will do the same thing of moving over the surface with a dark medium, then a light medium, many, many generations of re-seeing and reworking. And then the third influence is, believe it or not, is Michelangelo, because I studied his work a lot early in my drawing to develop my sense of space and volume. And so one of the ways in which I think my drawings differ, particularly from Cézanne's, is that they are much more spatial and have much more of a sense of surface. And that's a matter of sort of what I learned from Michelangelo being translated through the attitudes of Cézanne.
Mm-hmm. So the Giacometti paintings, if someone wants to look them up, they're portraits. It's like a man or a woman sitting very stiffly, very kind of boxy, mm-hmm. shoulders and things, black and white, and they're kind of gray in the middle, you know, around mm-hmm. the face, like he's really worked it often. What do you know what he did exactly? Was this oil?
It was oil, and he worked with pretty fine brushes. And he would often go back and forth between black and white, just as I do, just so that he could see what his marks were. So the change in value was just to have contrast in the marks. But because oil dries slowly, there is a tendency for the paintings to kind of gray out. Mm-hmm. That's the grayness that you were referring to.
Mm-hmm. There's a book, you said, by James Lord about the process of Giacometti's process.
Yeah, there's a book that I actually recommend to all my students called A Giacometti Portrait by James Lord. Wonderful book. It's only about 60 pages, and James Lord is sitting as a model for Giacometti, and he just chronicles what happens day by day in the process. And it's very inspirational for fellow makers because, number one, Giacometti is very frank about his frustration. So the assumption is, oh, this person's at the peak of their maturity and mastery. They must be pretty confident in what they're doing. And he's not at all. He says things like, if this doesn't get better in the next 30 minutes, I'm going to quit for good. How have I pulled off this charade so many years? But also, James Lord is just being driven crazy because he wants to buy this portrait at the end, and it keeps getting to these wonderful stages, and then Giacometti demolishes it and then rebuilds it again, and mm-hmm. he does this over and over. So the discussion of why one would rework a piece this way is very clear in that book, mm-hmm. and I think very helpful to fellow makers because it shows how much work it takes to develop a mature understanding of a subject matter.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that if somebody does first time they do a drawing, they should abandon it, erase it, or reconsider it? What's the beginning of that process?
Well, there's a great Picasso quote where he says that in the beginning you make some pretty discoveries. He says, but don't get sucked in by that. Destroy the thing over several times. And he says what you're learning doesn't get suppressed, it gets deepened. So one's first pass on a drawing is always going to be the most naive understanding of the subject. And so although it may be clear and decisive and sort of fetching, in general, you don't want to be seduced by that first pass because the piece can go so much farther than that.
Mm-hmm. Cezanne did this too, that you'd put the nose somewhere and then you'd have no problem putting the nose somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's not going back to the original nose and being kind of stuck with it.
I think it's the most radical and important thing about Cezanne's work, at least from my point of view, that he was one of the first artists to be frank about the fact that when we're drawing things, they move on us. You know, we look at something and we think we know where it is and we commit to that. And then the next time we look at it, it looks wider or it looks higher or whatever. And Cezanne, instead of just being bound by the first pass, would just come in the second time and mark the nose where he's seeing it now. And so you look at Cezanne's late works on paper, and there's always this ambiguity because he's re-seeing things and they're sort of moving on the page constantly.
So you say he towards the end of his life, he could paint a wine bottle, draw a wine bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And what would be the effect?
Well, if you look at the wine bottle, it's really convincing and looks like the best, most thoroughly observed wine bottle you've ever seen. But when you look at the edges and the details of it, you see that there are all kinds of restatements and contradictions about where exactly it is. And it's almost in his work as if the whole piece is made of nothing but errors, that each mark has some truth of the subject, but not the whole truth. And then if you have 1,000 versions of that truth, each one is somewhat wrong, but the grouping of them implies the truth in a way that no single mark could.
Mm-hmm. You've worked with David Beispiel, the poet, local poet, and he also runs a poetry writing class.
He runs the Attic, what's it called? It used to be the Attic Studio. Now I think it's the Attic Institute. And it's an independent studio like my studio, the drawing studio, but it's for writing while mine's for drawing and painting. David and I have known each other for a long time. I did the artwork for Poetry Northwest, which he edited for 5 years. How David fits into this is, for his last issue before he retired as editor, he wanted me to do a portrait of him. And this kind of intensive observation, ambiguous portrait, kind of emerged out of my 2 months of sittings with David. The very last three drawings of the series were the beginning of this kind of drawing for me.
Mm-hmm. So for his magazine, you would draw portraits of the poets or
illustrations? Yes, portraits of whoever was featured in that particular issue. And so primarily it was poets, but I also did a portrait of Johnny Cash. Sometimes it would be musicians.
Mm-hmm. But when he sat for you, what was the process?
Well, the process was I really had to learn his face. And so I just kept doing more versions of his face, sort of studying it from different points of view. And some of the drawings were very ambiguous, some were very explicit, but they were all about different dimensions of his face. And what's interesting is he wrote about this process in a book called Every Writer Has a Thousand Faces. The thesis of the work is that artists should put off committing to a first draft, because the typical model of working is to create a first draft and then try to fix all its problems.
So poets and painters?
Poets, painters, yeah, pretty much all the arts. He's suggesting something that I think most artists who've been working a long time have figured out, that the longer you can stall on making that first draft, the longer you can play with the material without committing to specific conclusions, the richer the conclusions are when you do start committing to a first draft. So he talks about ways in which he plays with the words that may be in his poems, their associations in every sense. He calls them word palettes, and just becomes familiar with more and more implications of these initial words, so that when he finally commits to the poem, there's a much richer understanding of the opportunities there.
Mm-hmm.
I actually just read an article in the New York Times about procrastination that was about the same process of starting something but not committing to a final version, so that you can have time to just cogitate.
Did you mean
realize more possibilities?
Not committing to a first draft or a final?
Well, in a way, both. The author of this article said that first he just played with the ideas in his head for a long time, and then he finally did start a draft, but he set it aside and then came back to it weeks later after he'd had a chance to think about it and really substantially rewrote it because all kinds of new possibilities emerged.
Mm-hmm. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Phil Sylvester. His show, Countenance, with David Slater, is on now at Gallery 114 through Sunday, February 28th. You also make guitars.
I do. I painted for years and showed my paintings in galleries, and my paintings morphed into these sort of sculptural pieces with found objects. And then that morphed into actually building my first guitar out of a bunch of pieces that I had around.
Electric guitar?
Electric guitar. I actually had been a professional musician before I became a visual artist, and so I played guitar and knew a lot about guitar. But I'm a very messy maker, and guitar making is very precise, so I thought, I can't make guitars. And then after years of painting, I decided, well, I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to see if I can make a guitar the way I make paintings, which meant, as with the drawings, building it and then tearing it apart and rebuilding it and tearing it apart. I did it. It worked. It was exciting. So for about 20 years, at least half of my work, if not two-thirds of my work, has been doing these peculiar guitars that have become fairly well known. I just got back from a really important invitational guitar show in Berlin where I was showing my instruments. My instruments are very rough, very peculiar looking, have all kinds of scars. They look like 20th century painting, rather than being as refined as luthiery or guitar making usually is.
Is the general shape of the guitar there?
It is, but I take more liberties with it. Just as with my drawings, I might make a shape for the guitar and then decide I'm not happy with it, and I'll add pieces of wood and cut away pieces of wood, and mm-hmm. so that the final shape is much more collaged than a typical guitar would be.
Mm-hmm. But still sounds good?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I was a professional musician, so my primary interest is in how these perform. And so actually my goals as a guitar maker are quite conservative. I'm trying to meet the standards of the very best instruments made in the U.S. in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they play really well, sound really well. And it's my biggest challenge with the guitars because people look at them and they look so strange, they think they're probably just for show, but they're actually primarily for performance.
Oh, wow. What happens to them? Do you sell them?
I've sold them in Europe and in the States. I've had interest in Japan. They always sell to musicians, to actual players. Mm-hmm. A lot of the players are sort of curious about them. And then when they get them in their hands, they say, oh my God, I didn't expect this to be such a beautiful sounding instrument.
Mm-hmm. When you said to be as good as the ones, the best guitars of the 50s and 60s, what brands were you thinking of?
Particularly Gibson and Fender. Just as I've studied great masters in visual art, I've really studied a lot of classic Gibson designs and Fender designs. But then also I will do experiments trying to create another structure than the traditional one that Fender used, for instance, and see if it still sounds good. And if it doesn't, modify it until it does. Mm-hmm. I actually use many recycled materials now. I use old instrument wood from the 50s and 60s and old pickups from the 50s and when I can find them.
Hmm. You said you self-taught as an artist?
Yes. I was not a typical artist. I was not a kid who was facile at drawing or was encouraged at drawing. So by the time I was an adult, I was sure that I could not do visual arts. But somehow I ended up in architecture school, and I was afraid of drawing. So I took a one semester class from a man named Jerry Buchanan, who was a New York painter. Turned out to be the best teacher I've ever studied under. He got me all fired up about drawing. But the interesting thing about Jerry's teaching is he didn't teach technique. He wouldn't teach us how to do anything. We'd say, how do you make shadows? And he'd say, yeah, there are lots of ways. Go experiment. Try some ways. I feel I can say I'm self-taught because everything I do from a technical standpoint, I've invented myself through my own experimentation and study. But he did really inspire us to explore and take risks. And we made incredible progress in this class where we weren't taught anything. Hmm. And my own teaching is very similar.
And it was observational drawing. So you'd say, how do I do these hands, or how do I do the shadow on an orange or something?
Yeah.
And he'd say,
come up with 10 possibilities and try them out. You know, learn by experimenting.
Yeah.
The miraculous thing was we progressed so much more quickly in that class than you would in a technique-based class that the whole rest of the university, anybody interested in visual arts, was coming to Jerry's class to see what was going on because it was so exciting. And people were just taking huge risks and really committed. It was thrilling.
What kind of risk could you take with a pencil?
Trying to do things you don't know how to do. That is, being willing to just dive in to something where you were completely lost. And so I think Jerry felt if you weren't functioning at that level of risk, you probably weren't making art at all. He got us very good at just being comfortable being lost, diving in when we didn't know what to do. And there's a great quote of Picasso's where he says, if you don't know how to draw something, start drawing it. We got very comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm. So you have the drawing studio at 36th and Division in Southeast. So anyone can show up, take a class, right?
There are classes for adults, and I will take younger people. The cutoff ages, they have to be seventh graders or older. But primarily, it's actually an incredible range of students, from people as young as seventh grade to people who are retired and everything in between. And many of my former students have become professional artists over the years, although that's not my primary concern. What I really am excited by is how the act of drawing lets you study the world. And so I'm happy to have students who have no art ambitions at all. They're just curious about drawing the way they would be curious about reading.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody, you know, goes to your class and learns kind of a self-taught kind of way of drawing a face,
mm-hmm.
is that the process, just the fact that they're doing their own thing? Or is it once they're done, they've learned to look at the world differently?
Well, the process of observation is sort of mysterious. You you stare at things and try to notice things, and not much happens. And you keep staring, and you keep throwing, making at it, and eventually little windows open up, and you notice a little bit more. And so I think that very process of struggling to observe completely changes how people view the physical world. I mean, for most of us, we just look at things long enough to identify them. But for drawers, we really slow down and start inspecting the full complexity of what we're observing. And any subject, you know, looking at the mixing board here in the studio, I could draw from that for 5 minutes, 5 days, 5 years, because it's inexhaustible in terms of the amount of detail and structure.
Mm-hmm. So Gary's face that you know so well, but you say is a complicated face.
Uh-huh.
You could keep drawing that for another few years.
Yeah, Gary is 70, and older faces are far more interesting to draw because they have so much detail. And I've drawn him for about 5 years, once a week for 5 years, and I can easily imagine studying. I mean, I feel like I'm just barely scratching the surface of how I read his face. After all this time, I could study him another 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's another connection to Giacometti, because Giacometti's favorite subject was his brother, and he just painted him over and over and over again his whole career and felt, you know, he was never done.
Mm-hmm. Can you sit in front of a mirror and draw your own face?
I can, and I have. I've done a lot of self-portraits, but I don't find my own face as fascinating as somebody else's face. Plus, with somebody else, I get to talk to them while I'm drawing, and you know, I'm sort of tired of hearing my own voice.
Yeah. Well, are you going for the kind of the wisdom or the sort of anthropogenic ideas people might have about someone's face, the personality of the person? What is the interesting detail that you fascinated by?
In many ways, I'm not trying to create any single thing. I want to actually draw in a way that lets me respond to every way that I respond to the person that I'm observing. So the marks can be driven by emotional response. It can be driven by the volumes and the space and the masses of the head. It can be driven by details. And I actually have been all these years trying to create a way of drawing that lets me jump back and forth among all those different ways of seeing.
Right.
Without having to say, this one's just about that, or this one's about that.
You know? And you're primarily drawing these days. You're not painting much?
Yes, I am. My primary visual art is drawing. My painting has kind of, I consider my guitars my paintings now, because they all involve color and composition, and so that's where that color interest went.
Have you had a show of them in Portland?
I did have a show years ago of the guitars along with paintings, and I actually haven't shown in a Portland gallery for 17 years, because that show with the guitars made it clear that guitars weren't a very good fit for the galleries. And galleries in town aren't particularly interested in drawings. I've been told by gallerists that they can't sell drawings.
Mm-hmm.
So since I was making the guitars and the drawings, there was nothing to show in the galleries. But then, David made this offer, and I would love to show in the galleries purely as a drawer, to say drawing is an art in and of itself, and it's not a lesser art than painting or anything else.
Mm-hmm. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Phil Sylvester. His show with David Slater is called Countenance, and it's on now at Gallery 114, which is in the Pearl on Gleason and 11th, and it runs through February 28th. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
Andy Warhol looks a scream.
Portland Community Radio. Yeah! Muy buenas tardes, esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día 16 de febrero de 2016. Durante su visita a San Cristóbal de las Casas, el Papa Francisco llamó a aprender de los pueblos indígenas y a pedirles perdón por haberles excluido de la sociedad y haberlos despojado de sus tierras y su cultura. Ante miles de indígenas, tzotzales, tzotziles, choles, tojolabales, mam y cachiquiles reunidos en el Centro Deportivo Municipal, el pontífice emitió un mensaje profundo y escuchó sus palabras en diferentes lenguas. Mientras tanto, desde la Casa del Migrante en Saltillo, donde transitan miles de viajeros cada semana, esperan también alcanzar la mirada del pontífice hacia la tragedia de los que atraviesan México desde Centroamérica. El presidente boliviano Evo Morales, primer presidente indígena en ese país, asegura tener pruebas que demuestran la injerencia estadounidense contra su gobierno. Morales afirma que Estados Unidos intenta confundir a la población boliviana con miras al referendo constitucional del próximo domingo, en el que se decidirá si el mandato de Evo Morales logra postularse a una nueva reelección. En Río Grande, Brasil, se ha suspendido el uso de un larvicida después de que informes apuntan hacia una posible relación con el defecto de la microcefalia. Cabe recordar que Brasil ha tenido un aumento en los casos de microcefalia vinculados con el virus del Zika transmitido por mosquitos. Sin embargo, dos grupos de promoción de la salud aseguran que podría estar relacionado con un larvicida obtenido por una filial japonesa de Monsanto que ha sido utilizado para detener el desarrollo de larvas de mosquitos en el agua potable. El Departamento de Tesoro del gobierno del presidente Obama aprobó la semana pasada la apertura de la primera fábrica estadounidense en Cuba en más de medio siglo. Autorizó una empresa de Alabama que construye una planta que ensamblaría hasta 1,000 tractores pequeños al año para su venta a agricultores independientes en la isla. La compañía podría fabricar tractores y otro equipo pesado en una zona económica especialmente habilitada por el gobierno cubano para atraer inversión extranjera. En Argentina, la inflación está convirtiéndose en uno de los principales problemas del inicio del gobierno de Mauricio Macri ante la perspectiva de una